Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 42. My name is Karen. Your name is Kristen.
Yes. Hi.
And for the first time in 42 episodes, we started on time today.
It is true.
I'm very proud of us.
You know, some days.
It's difficult.
We got it together eventually.
Yeah. I wonder if this will be easier when we're not living together, like, because there'll be a set time for you to, like, come over and, like, you know, versus, well, like...
I am regularly 15 to 20 minutes late when it's not time sensitive.
Yeah.
If things are time sensitive, if it's a concert, if it's... someone needs me at a specific time for a reason or whatever. I'm really good at being on time. But when time is not really...
So what you're saying is Prophecy Radio's not high enough priority for you.
Well, no, I'm saying it probably will be.
Oh, okay, okay.
But, like, as long as time is of the essence, yeah. I can be on time. But the rest of the time, I'm usually late.
Yeah, I'm... I can't say much because I feel like I usually am, too. I'm either early because I'm super anxious or late because I decided to try to do too many things before I left.
Honestly, I'm blaming the fact that my father made us get everywhere, like, 45 minutes early, like, oh my God. For everything.
That's
like,
intense.
Yeah, like, my dad likes to be early. So I'm kind of blaming that on the fact that as an adult, I'm like, does this matter? No.
Yeah.
I can go I'll get there when I get there. It'll be fine. Like, I kind of blame him.
That's hilarious. That 45 minutes is a long time.
Sometimes it was an hour. Sometimes it was 30 minutes. It just depended on what it was.
And yeah.
He likes being early. He doesn't like being late to things. So we always got there early.
Yeah. Understandable.
Yeah.
Well, if you would like to tell us what family traumas you have... You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. I have started posting things to Tumblr, which means you should go follow us there if you haven't already. I think we have 5 followers.
No, so thanks, guys.
Kind of cute, but not very many. That's okay. It'll get there. But right now, we're going to jump into news and updates, and despite the fact that we're recording this 2 days later than the previous episode,
yes,
there's actually a couple of things to talk about, so I was kind of excited about this.
There's always news.
Yeah, there'll probably still be a lot to catch up on when I get back from San Diego Comic-Con, but at least we had some things to discuss in the meantime. So, first and foremost, Roseanne A. Brown has a campaign to get her Rick Riordan Presents book, Serwa Boateng's Guide to Vampire Hunting, into the hands of Black educators and librarians. So, I'm going to link to her tweet. There's, like, a Google form that you can fill out if you know anybody, or, like, you could pass it on to the people who are, you know, Black educators and librarians, and then they'll get, I think, like, free copies of the book and guides to the book and that sort of thing so that they can teach it, which is very exciting, and I love that. There's a lot of stuff for that for Tristan Strong, too, so if you're interested in this, check out what they have for Tristan Strong, because I'm sure it'll be a lot of similar stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. So cool.
Yeah. Reed Riordan also posted another article. I feel like they've been banging these out lately, so that's kind of cool. And it is, how well do you know the Heroes of Olympus quotes? And we're not going to go through this quiz, even though I do love doing quizzes with Kristen, but we don't really have time today. And also, I would probably fail this because it's been a very long time since I read those books. Depending on how famous the quotes are.
Yeah, I hear you. It's been a little while since I read Heroes of Olympus, too. I was going to say, I'm sure we'd get a handful of them.
Yeah.
But there's probably some specific ones that we'd be like...
There's probably some tricky ones in there.
I recognize this, but I don't know who said it. And that would drive me nuts.
Yeah, exactly. So if you guys take it, let us know how you did. That's pretty cool. You know what else is cool?
I saw this.
The Empire State Building is a huge fan of Percy Jackson, apparently, which I love. So at Empire State BLDG on Twitter is the official Empire State Building Twitter account. They have 216,000 followers right now, and they've been tweeting out pictures and, you know, stuff like that. Just a lot of interesting things about the Empire State Building. And they tweeted out Olympus's address,
yes,
which was pretty cool,
mm-hmm,
and also tweeted, Percy Jackson is a friend of mine, and tweeted, Zeus and I go way back, and it's a picture of a lightning bolt hitting the top of the Empire State Building.
Yeah, I saw that one this morning.
And I'm just kind of obsessed.
Like
to give you an example of the power of the Percy Jackson fandom, they tweeted about NASA's new images with the galaxies and everything like that. 74 likes, okay, on that picture. Even some of the other ones, 43 likes on a picture. There's a video with 124 likes. The one about Zeus, 17,000 likes. So if that gives you any idea.
We are not small and we are mighty.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it.
I
honestly
love it too.
I'm just, whoever is running Empire State Building social media, like, apparently they're
smart.
A big Percy fan, and
yeah.
I love it. Like, that's the kind of thing you should be doing. I would be completely enthralled if later on they started talking about, like, Sleepless in Seattle and things like
right?
that, too.
Yeah.
Like, these are the, if you're a national monument and you are on social media, you should be talking about all of the popular culture that mentions you.
Mm-hmm.
Do it, because it's just an extra special little thing to see Percy, to see Percy's stuff showing up on
yeah.
the Empire State Building thing. It's just lovely.
It's so cute. And, like, fans are obviously going to react to that, so
oh, yeah.
it's just smart. Okay, last bit of news for today is the trailer for Secret Headquarters is out. This movie stars Walker Scobell, as well as Owen Wilson, Jesse Williams, and Michael Pena. And honestly, it looks really good. Like, it looks really cute. It's for, you know, younger kids, like 12-year-olds, because
yeah.
those are what the main characters are. And essentially, Walker is Owen's son, which, great casting.
Yeah.
I think they do actually look quite a lot alike.
They do.
And Walker's character finds out that his dad's a superhero. He discovers his secret headquarters and finds out his dad's a superhero. Michael Pena plays the bad guy. And it looks really cute and kind of gives me some Percy Jackson vibes with, like, discovering powers and that
yeah.
sort of thing.
Secrets about your father.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, oh my gosh, though, Walker, we know he's super talented, but the movies that he's coming out with, the projects that he has on his plate so early into his career, it's like hit after hit after hit.
Yeah, it is really.
I mean,
he's doing very well.
Yeah, working with Ryan Reynolds, now working with Owen Wilson and all of the other people that he's got to work with. It's just incredible, and I am very much here for it.
Okay, I'm more excited for the actors that are attached to this that you don't see in the trailer. Jesse Williams from Grey's Anatomy
mm-hmm.
hasn't done a whole lot of other stuff. Like, he was a math teacher before he decided to act.
So, okay.
like, he taught kids whatever, and then was, like, really loved acting, whatever, and decided to start, like, applying for things. And, like, he was in Cabin in the Woods, and he's done Grey's Anatomy. And that's pretty much it. I mean, I think there might be a couple other little things. But, like, he has not done a ton of acting. So it's just really exciting. I was like, oh, he's in that, too? Not to mention Mamona Tamada from the Babysitter's Club. Like, the minute she showed up on screen, I was like, oh, she's in that, too? Like,
yeah.
I loved her in Babysitter's Club. So,
and a lot of people want her to be in Percy Jackson.
Right? She's been hanging around all of them because she's also in Vancouver working on projects and things. And now knowing that she's worked with Walker on this kind of explains why she's, you know, all hanging around all the time. Not just, like, you know, as much as I want her in Percy, too, because she's fantastic. I just think it's really fun and cute, and I love her. So, yeah, I'm honestly very excited for this. It looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it comes out August 5th, so that's actually pretty soon.
Yeah,
so
it's only a couple weeks away. Yeah,
and it will be on Paramount+. which, thank goodness, we have a login for that, so we can watch it.
You're welcome.
Yes.
My Big Brother addiction pays off once again.
All right. We are getting into our main discussion today, which is our monster guide on Medusa. And I have been looking forward to this episode for a while because I'm fascinated by Medusa's myth and the modern interpretations of her story. So I want to give you a little rundown on her origins to begin with. And we've talked about this between Poseidon and Athena's episodes. We've talked about Medusa quite a bit. So I'm not trying to be like too repetitive here, but I want to give you a pretty succinct rundown of what happened. So sure. Essentially, Poseidon became obsessed with a woman named Medusa, and Medusa was very flattered by this attention, and he took her to Athena's temple and had sex with her, which was a huge insult to Athena, of course. You don't do that in somebody else's temple. Come on.
Especially a maiden goddess.
Yeah, it's not a good look, Poseidon, really. And Athena noticed what was happening and changes Medusa into a monster. She gives her brass or gold bat wings, brass talons, and hair made of venomous snakes. Rick once again said poisonous snakes, and I was like, that's wrong. Venomous snakes, and a face so horrible it would turn a mortal to stone. Very well-known information.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Now, Poseidon basically abandoned Medusa as soon as this happened, and she retreated into a cave to live with her two sisters, who were eventually transformed into monsters themselves because of their close proximity to Medusa. And they were known, the trio was known as the Gorgons, and the gods made the sisters immortal so that they would be with Medusa for all time. And I found this interesting because Medusa was mortal, but mm-hmm. she lived for a long time. So I don't know if, you know, turning into a monster gave her some sort of longevity or something like that.
But well, it's like, I'm wondering if that was the ultimate, like, punishment. Is that in addition to being this monster, she also has to live with it forever?
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, not even forever necessarily, because they were very clear in several spots that she is mortal. Like, she's able to be killed in a way that her sisters weren't. So I find that interesting because it extended her life but didn't give her the powers of immortality. So I don't really know how that works. I don't think a lot of other people do, you know, because
it's like vampires. They can live forever as long as nobody sticks them with the pointy end.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So Medusa's face became the symbol of Athena because of this. And it was basically a warning of what would happen if you crossed her, which a lot of people were very fearful of this. And I was kind of thinking about it. I was like, oh, okay, that kind of makes sense then that Medusa's hair was made of snakes because we just recently learned that one of Athena's sacred animals is the snake.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Medusa's face got on the aegis, the shield or the cloak, depending on what myth you're going by. So all of that I feel like we've talked about before.
Yeah. And a good basis to kind of understand.
Yeah.
How Medusa came to be.
Mm-hmm. Of course, now we get into the story of Perseus, which I think we've talked about a little less on the podcast so far. And I learned some interesting things about this because I feel like I knew very general things about Perseus from either reading the books or just, you know, in general, like you kind of know he's the guy who kills Medusa. But it turns out that King Polydectes was gathering presents for his friend's daughter's wedding, and Perseus was forced to attend this party, but because he was poor, he didn't have anything to offer. However, he was already a legendary warrior by this point, so he was essentially forced to promise on the River Styx to do a favor for King Polydectes, which, you know, that's a big deal, because
right.
if you break that, Hades is going to come for you and you're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah.
And so the king kind of forces Perseus to swear on the River Styx. And then he says, okay, I want you to bring me the head of Medusa. And everyone's like, oh, snap. Do people still say that? I don't know. Oh, snap.
We do. So I guess we're people.
They definitely said it in ancient Greece, though. And now Perseus was like, well, what am I going to do? He was in quite the pickle. So he prayed to his father, Zeus. He was a son of Zeus. And Hermes came down. So not Zeus. Zeus was like, yeah, I'll send the messenger god. Hermes came down to help him and gave him a sack to put Medusa's head in and a helmet to turn him invisible, as well as winged sandals. And I was looking at, like, the Wikipedia page, too, and Percy says that the helmet was like a copy of Hades' invisibility helm. But in other myths, it was like all of these gods gave him something. And Hades gave him his helm to borrow. And Hermes gave him the winged sandals and, and that sort of thing. So
I was going to say, those winged sandals.
Yeah, exactly. I saw that. I was like, oh, is this going to be a trap? It was not a trap. They were they were the real deal. But it's very interesting that all of these gods are conspiring with Perseus to kill Medusa. So Hermes basically sends Perseus to go visit the Grey Sisters, who do share some ancestry with the Gorgons, so they're like kind of related. They're also a trio of sisters. And he was meant to go there to get more items. So they're the ones that have one eye and one tooth between the three of them.
Yeah.
We've talked about that a little bit before. And he stole their eye and their tooth and essentially forced them to give him the location of the Gorgons' lair, as well as the weapons of the prophecy. Basically, Athena placed a very shiny shield and a sword at the bottom of a tree for the day that someone would come to release Medusa from her curse. So she kind of knew that this day was coming, put it there for whoever ended up doing it, and it was, of course, Perseus. So you have another god helping to kill Medusa. And this is where I want to talk a little bit about what's going on, because Percy makes a point of saying that the Gorgons never really bothered anybody, but everybody was always trying to kill them, basically because it was like a super hard quest. So they just stayed in their cave and didn't really go out and like terrorize the countryside or anything, but people kept coming to try to kill them and nobody ever succeeded. They all got turned to stone. And I'm just like, I get that it's like, oh, here's this boss that's really hard to beat. I'm going to go try to beat her. But at the same time, if they're not doing anything, I feel kind of bad for Medusa.
Yeah. No, I definitely feel bad for Medusa. I kind of see it as there's all these people who are trying to get to Elysium and they're like, this one will do it. Like, again, they're misguided heroes who think, like, I have to slay the right beast and that'll get me there. And it's like, no, that's not it. That's not anywhere near it. But okay. So I can kind of see like how that came to be a big thing. Like nobody's done it. The person who does will have released us from, you know, like Medusa's in her cave. Leave her alone. Like she doesn't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
Like just leave her be. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. But I can kind of see how it became like a big,
right,
crazy thing.
The other interesting thing is that in Percy Jackson's Greek Heroes, Athena says that Medusa has suffered long enough. So she wants Perseus to go release her from her curse by killing her, of course. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, why couldn't Athena just release her herself? Either send her on her way, if that means destroying her, but in a less gruesome way, or literally taking the curse off of her. Now, from Athena's point of view, she probably can't because that would look like weakness. But at the same time, if Athena's like, yeah, no, you've been punished long enough, you're good, and then sends this hero off to kill her, like, that kind of stinks.
Well, I still think a god showing weakness, they can't show weakness. Why can't they show weakness? They're not humans holding on to power that the minute they lose power, they're going to be slaughtered in the streets.
Yeah.
They're gods. They can't die. They're just hanging out up there. Be merciful. Be a wonderful person as well as God. Do nice things. Why do none of them do nice things? Like, they pretend to do nice things, but it always ends up screwing some hero in one way or another.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, Athena, you've done plenty to prove your power and to prove your might and your, you know, all of the things that we love about Athena. She's done plenty of things to prove that to us. If she had just let Medusa go and said, you know what? It takes two to tango, and I'm not punishing Poseidon, so your curse is lifted.
Yeah.
Like, I agree. She should have done it. She should have just let her be.
Mm-hmm.
And said, you know what? Live with your sisters in your cave. You don't need to be monsters anymore. Have a nice life.
Yeah. I wonder if part of it is that mortals might... Obviously, we're thinking of this as... It's difficult in whether you believe that the gods are real and these are, you know, real things that happened versus...
True.
...the stories that people made up to explain certain things that happened in history. And I could see, you know, in the former camp, the gods would worry that the mortals would stop worshiping them if they showed weakness. So, like, there is... They might not be able to die in the sense, but as we've seen in Percy Jackson, if they're stopped... If people stop worshiping them, their power decreases and, you know, they're not going to want to do that. And at the same time, if this is the other camp, I wonder if it's a story about being merciful and how... kings and such might not want to show that, or like, do you know what I'm saying? In terms of if it's an allegory for power, needing to keep the power at all times and sending somebody else to do your dirty work and not necessarily admitting to what you did wrong.
Yeah.
I can see a lot of kings, you know, relating to that kind of story.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely more the second than the first, because I think if... It never has made sense to me that people have, the different religions especially, have, like, these all-powerful beings that don't understand how, like, what mercy is. Mm-hmm. Like, as an all-powerful being, you think they would understand the value of being, you know, forgiving and being, you know, a person that can see to the heart of these humans or whatever creatures you're, like, the god of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, like, that... I understand in a lot of Greek myths, especially, or, like, Greek, you know, god tales, they are terrified to, like, show weakness. And it's probably because there's so many of them and they're kind of competing for followers themselves.
Right.
So I can kind of, I mean, there's plenty of ways to explain it, but I don't know. It just, like, weirds me out. Like,
yeah.
I would think you'd get more followers if you showed that, like, you could see what they were going through and say, I understand. I'm going to let you go, like, I'm going to relieve you of this curse, because I've seen you suffer, you've paid your price, you know, you've paid the price for what you did, moving on. Like,
yeah.
I would think that would get them more followers.
I'm curious how many Greek myths actually show the gods being merciful, because I'm sure that there are some,
probably.
At least, but also, if you think about it, mythology is a lot about, like, learning lessons, and I keep thinking about Athena and Arachne, where she went down and said, hey, I'll give you a second chance, all you have to do is thank me, and Arachne said no and was punished, and that is a story for other people to be like, hey, don't be prideful,
yeah.
Be humble, thank the gods, remember where you came from, and everything will work out for you. So,
yeah,
depends on what lessons
yeah.
need to be learned, but it's very interesting. Okay, another quick note is that Perseus was meant to chop off Medusa's head, and he learns that Medusa still has the power to turn mortals to stone after she's been decapitated, which is why he has to keep her head in a sack. And Athena basically is like, oh yeah, you know, she's still a weapon or whatever. And we know that Medusa can turn people to stone. Athena specifically says marble at one point. And I was just kind of like, I guess I never really thought about what kind of stone that Medusa turns people into. Because in, like, the Percy Jackson movie and a lot of other visual adaptations of the Medusa story, it's usually a gray stone, like a very normal looking gray stone. But, like, what if it was marble? What if it was, like, a really nice piece of marble or literally any other kind of stone out there? It could be, like, some sort of gemstone or something.
It's like, I would like to request emerald.
Yeah, right? Like, wouldn't that be a really interesting visual?
An emerald statue or a granite statue?
Or she can choose which one, and, like, she's just got full statues of, like, ruby people and jade people. And,
like, slate, if she really doesn't like you.
Yeah.
Like, this really dark gray, although even slate is cool.
Yeah, slate is kind of cool.
So, like, yeah, that would be kind of funny.
Yeah.
Never thought about that either.
One more thing before we get to Perseus actually killing Medusa is that, like I said, the two other Gorgons are immortal, but Medusa isn't. However, she did live for a long time, and I was trying to figure out how long she actually lived, and I tried to Google, because some people think that Perseus and Medusa were historical figures that have been conflated and turned into like legend and myth. So they were trying to figure out possibly when they could have lived based on certain historical cues and when the story started to come about. And these two are several hundred years apart, they think. But the problem is that chronology in myth is very difficult because we also know that Athena has always had like the Aegis and the symbol of Medusa. And this was after Perseus did all of, you know, his stuff. So I don't know in terms of like art history and the depictions if there was a time period where she wasn't depicted with Medusa's head and then was.
Right.
And if you can actually follow that chronology, that would take a lot more research that is outside the scope of this podcast, even though as an art history nerd, I really want to look into this, but I was trying to be good.
Yeah.
But I just think it's really interesting that basically how long Medusa actually lived as this monstrous creature, which there's another very specific reason why I'm curious about this, which we'll get to in a second. But
okay.
Who knows? She was mortal, but she definitely lived longer than her average human lifespan. Okay, so Perseus gets to Medusa's cave, and okay, so it was the next point. She's pregnant with Poseidon's baby. She is a very pregnant monster gorgon woman, and she's been unable to give birth since Poseidon had sex with her in Athena's temple. So if she's lived for hundreds of years, she might have been pregnant for hundreds of years.
She's got a 200-year-old baby just hanging out.
Yeah, like that would be miserable. I feel like 9 months is long enough.
Oh, yeah. No.
And I cannot imagine hundreds of years.
Absolutely not.
It's so horrible.
That's rough, yeah.
Yeah. So Perseus lops off her head with the sword. He uses the shield as a mirror to look at her so he doesn't turn to stone. He does it while she's sleeping. And from the blood seeping out of her neck, Pegasus is born.
Interesting.
Very interesting. kind of makes sense, though, because horses and Poseidon and that sort of thing. And Chrysaor, I think is how you pronounce his name. A golden warrior was also born. So they're twins, essentially, both born of Medusa and Poseidon. And Percy specifically says in this section, you want stuff to make sense? You're in the wrong universe. And I'm just like, that's Greek mythology in a nutshell.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, people popping out of people's heads. Here you slay her and two babies pop out of her neck. Like,
yeah.
What are we doing?
Yeah.
What are we doing? But it is interesting.
It's super interesting. And I think the story of Pegasus especially is so interesting because I always think of like very cute Pegasus from Hercules and that's how he was born. But then you also have Blackjack being a descendant of the original Pegasus and all of that. And it's very interesting to think of how everybody is related because Percy Jackson is a son of Poseidon, but also bears the name of Perseus, son of Zeus. And then he meets Medusa in that first book, and she has like so many reasons to hate him and his family lineage. And then he's riding Blackjack, who's technically like his
great, 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 great grandchild.
Well, it would be his brother. Because it's Poseidon's son. Pegasus is Poseidon's son. And if Blackjack is his child, Percy is his uncle? Yeah, Percy would be Blackjack's uncle, technically.
Well, no, because Percy's Poseidon's son, and Pegasus is
Poseidon's son.
Right, so they would be brothers.
Brothers, but Blackjack is a descendant of Pegasus. So, technically, Percy is Blackjack's uncle.
Maybe great-great-great-uncle.
It's somewhere in there. But isn't that so interesting?
That is very weird.
Very, very strange. But, hey, you want stuff to make sense? You're in the wrong universe.
She's looking at her great-great-great-grandchild, you know.
Yeah,
come to slay her, you know.
Yeah, it's very messy.
Yeah.
Messy, messy Greek mythology. Okay, so the last part of this story that I found very interesting is that Medusa's tale doesn't end there. Like, a lot of the times, these monsters are slain and the hero goes on to do other quests. And like, yes, that becomes part of their legend. But in Medusa's case, she kind of lives on in a way because her head is still a very useful weapon. Perseus uses Medusa's head to save Andromeda from a sea monster, and then they get married. Yay for them. And they arrive back to the kingdom of Polydectes, who's trying to marry Perseus's mom against her will. So Perseus turns all of those guys to stone. And eventually he gives back all of his magical items to the gods and gifts Medusa's head to Athena, who has it bronzed and mounted on Aegis. So,
yeah.
You know, I just using Medusa's head after she's killed, especially when we get into some of the legacy stuff, it feels really disrespectful to me. I know that, like, Medusa's meant to be this monster that Perseus slays and that he's the hero of the story, but there's a lot of reasons why feminists especially kind of relate to Medusa's story and why her story has stayed very popular in all sorts of media, but also has become a symbol for kind of the opposite of what it was in the original story. So, yeah, we'll get to that in a second. But now that we have a full picture of Medusa, because we talked in The Lightning Thief about feeling kind of bad for her even when Perseus ends up killing her. Like, she's not quite like the other monsters.
Yeah, like so many females that get tied up with gods and then get punished by other gods because of it. Like, it's hard not to feel bad for these people because, like, they didn't know necessarily what they were getting into. Like, the god came down and entered their world and their life and then basically wrecked it.
Yeah.
You know, like, Medusa didn't ask for Poseidon, you know. She didn't ask for Athena to get offended and not to punish Poseidon, but to instead punish the woman he was with. Like, you know, it's hard not to be at least somewhat on Medusa's side, just a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, especially since she's apparently hid in her cave the whole time, just wanted to be left alone.
Yeah, none of what I read in either Percy Jackson's Greek Gods or Greek Heroes said anything about her going out and, like, killing people, or there weren't other stories of her doing things to other people.
Right, because, like, I could see if she was terrorizing the countryside, why she would need to be slain, or if she was, you know, even accidentally, like, leaving the cave to go do normal human things and was accidentally turning people to stone. Like, even then I can kind of understand humans being like, we can't allow this to continue.
Yeah.
Like, she, you know, has a power that could, wipe us out. I would get that, but she literally just stayed with her sisters and hid in her cave and was like, just leave me be. And they just couldn't. So yeah, there's a lot of reasons to kind of like feel for Medusa in this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Percy context, she does try actively to turn them to stone.
Yes.
So it becomes a little different when she's like weaponized her own power.
Right.
Like that, you know, you feel a little less bad. But like in the actual historical story context, it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of historical context, I want to talk about the legacy of Medusa's story a little bit because I find this particularly fascinating just because of how it has lingered in our society. Like, a lot of people know the story of Medusa. Even if they don't know all the details, they know what she looks like. It's a very popular story. And also how the meaning has transformed over the years. So, just to start off, even to utter Medusa's name was a sign of bad luck in ancient Greece. People really, really were scared of her. And again, not entirely sure why if she just stayed in her cave the entire time.
I guess the idea of knowing that just outside of town, there's this woman who, if she looks at you, turns you to stone.
Yeah.
Like, that would be scary. So I guess I can kind of see it from that perspective. But the fact that nobody had ever seen her without going to her is a different part of it. Yeah.
Now, there is some historical context as to how this story might have come about. It says that the Hellenes, which I think is just another word for, like, Greek people, like...
I believe so.
Yeah.
Probably from a certain area.
Yeah, exactly. Overran the shrines of a particular goddess whose priestesses wore hideous masks to keep away the profane, And because of that, the trauma of this, like the societal shared trauma of this event, spawned the myth, which again, like it kind of alludes to a certain time period when Medusa could have been alive, and also like when her myth came about and how long she like lived in mythology. Now, Freud's psychoanalysis, which, you know, Freud, good old Freud, what a weird guy with weird psychology things. His psychoanalysis is essentially like the Medusa complex, or whatever he called it, is about a son seeing his mother as a sexual being for the first time and being frozen in fear of the father's retribution. Because in the mythology, there are no stories of women being turned to stone. So he believes that this has some sort of sexual relevance with sons and their mothers, because of course it always comes back with Freud to either a mother or a father thing. And he references, like, you know, Oedipus and that sort of thing in relation to all of this. So
yeah. I mean, if you're looking at human understanding and like trying to psychoanalyze like how things come to be, mm-hmm. I can see using Medusa and the Medusa myth as a way to describe this condition of like you know, boys growing up into men, understanding that they came from somewhere, and like the realization of that, and that kind of being a transformative time in your life where like a part of your psyche kind of freezes at that moment, mm-hmm. and you're like, okay, that, you know, it's a very like, I can kind of see that. And Medusa would be a good way to kind of understand and describe that to someone, because everyone understands the Medusa myth.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's very interesting. As someone who has not studied Freud, but every time I hear another thing, I'm just like, wow, yeah, interesting. Okay, yeah. Sure. I'll use interesting because I don't have another word.
Yeah. I know that he's very, very important to the field of psychology, but at the same time,
I was going to say, I think some people have also looked into the validity of some, like, obviously, yeah. He was the father of, like, some modern psychology. And so, like, it's understandable that he was doing the best he could at the time, but now people are kind of looking back on some of his things, and I know some of it is like, maybe that's not really the best way to look at this, you know.
Yeah.
But that's just time. I mean,
he was doing
the best he could, I think, at the time, and was making great strides. So that's all very interesting.
Definitely. And of course, neither of us have a degree in psychology.
Right. I know
so
very little, and
who the heck are we?
Soak up what I can.
Exactly. Now, the one that I am most interested in is feminist interpretations of the Medusa myth, because a lot of people have gone back to look at this myth, and I couldn't find, like, in Percy's version of the story, Medusa was very flattered by Poseidon's approach, but a lot of modern feminist interpretations say that she is the victim of rape, and that it's basically a story of a man using his influence and power over a woman to get what he wants, and then the woman being punished, you know, victim blaming and that sort of thing. And so a lot of feminists use her story, and specifically her image, as a symbol of female rage. And you will see that a lot of women are now getting like Medusa tattoos if they've been sexually assaulted and that sort of thing. And I actually really like this interpretation of it, because I think that it's very relatable for a lot of people. And I like the idea of going back and looking at somebody that we've always known to be a monster, as somebody who's hideous. And, I mean, we know now maybe not as aggressive, but somebody who was killing people by turning them to stone, and going, okay, wait a second. She was being blamed for something that Poseidon did that she had maybe had absolutely no hand in. But even if she did, he was clearly using his influence over her to get what he wanted. So,
yeah, when we read that first point about Freud and the all of that, you have a note that you said there are no stories of women being turned to stone. I was as I read that, I was like, that kind of explains a little bit of her use as a feminist icon. Like,
right.
Not only is her whole situation and the whole story very relatable, you know, especially if you look at how willing was she with Poseidon, what was she, you know, he was making choices for her. Like, he was affecting her. He was, you know, that's all very loosey-goosey. Like, we don't know exactly yeah. what happened between the two of them and how much influence he used. And so just, yeah, I was thinking about it. I'm like, well, even despite all of that and despite a woman being the one who turned her into this monster, she still doesn't take it out on women.
Yeah.
Like, she's still... all the stories are about men being mm-hmm. turned to stone. And, you know, it's kind of interesting that, like, she chooses not to perpetuate the woman-on-woman crime that yeah. has happened here because then she again, could have.
Right. And, you know, just thinking about this as a full picture, is that because she stayed in her cave and only men went to go to try to right. kill her, which, again, is even still this idea that, like, men are constantly... choosing violence on women who are mm-hmm. doing nothing and
yeah, you know, it makes going a lot out of their sense. Way.
It does, yeah. I would honestly, and I'm sure they are out there, so if our listeners have any recommendations, I would honestly read an entire book about this myth and the feminist interpretation of all of that. But there's one more interpretation, and it has to do with nihilism. And I pulled this right from the Wikipedia, and it basically says, attempts to avoid looking into her eyes represent avoiding the ostensibly depressing reality that the universe is meaningless. So,
oh, nihilism.
Right? So that's a really peppy end to this section. I have nothing to say about that in all reality. It's
They basically just, yeah, that's so weird. Yeah. Why don't you choose that in like, it sounds like they basically view Medusa as, like, a vessel to look at the reality of the universe, and, like, mm-hmm. seeing the universe for what it actually is, which is meaningless and pointless. And so, like, the myth of men turning to stone when they realize the universe is meaningless, like, that's so weird.
Or the fact that looking into Medusa's eyes is death, instant right. death. So, you know, avoiding to look at death.
Right, staying oblivious to the realities of the universe, you can live a happy life, but the minute you see the universe for what it is and that there is no point to anything...
you might as well die.
You might as well die, yeah. Like, that's incredibly weird, and yeah. thanks, nihilism. Like, we appreciate it.
Jeez Louise. Okay, I wanted to end this section with another podcast. We're giving you guys another podcast recommendation, and it's the Monstrous Woman podcast. And this is from a few of our Rick Riordan, Percy Jackson podcast friends, Quinn, Megan, and Fran, who are on an episode, and I'll link to the specific episode where they talk about Medusa. And if this was an interesting discussion for you guys, if you want to hear somebody else talk about it, if you want to hear potentially more information and a deeper dive into the Medusa myth with regards also to Percy Jackson, because they will talk about Percy Jackson there, go check out this episode, Monstrous Woman podcast. I think you guys will like it. All three of these people are wonderful.
Very cool. Very cool.
But that's Medusa in a nutshell. And I feel like...
misunderstood a little.
Yeah. I just, the more I learn about this myth, the more I want to know. So...
yeah, like over time, she's definitely become this... femme fatale evil woman yeah. who stalks the streets turning men into stone, and you know, like, that's kind of become her mm-hmm. legacy, but the real story kind of is like yeah. it's a little different.
You're right, because, and I didn't mention this, but Athena made her into a monster, gave her such an ugly face, but later on the interpretations changed and said that she was stunningly beautiful, but she still turned you to stone. So it was like a femme fatale kind yeah. of thing
yeah.
as it progressed.
With
so,
this ability to, you know, end you with a glance.
Yeah.
Like, it feels very like women are evil kind
exactly.
of thing.
Which, and their sexual power is evil and that sort yeah. of thing, which we've seen in many other stories across all, many cultures. Yeah. I shouldn't say all, but.
So it is very interesting to see how it all originated and like, that's kind of different from yeah. everything I know about Medusa. That's
exactly. So if you guys have any further reading, please let us know. I would probably read just about anything about this. So thank you very much. But let's get into our Battle of the Labyrinth chapters. We are coming in hot to the end of this book.
I know. It feels like it kind of came up quick.
Yeah.
All of a sudden. I know we're getting close-ish, but now, like, this is the penultimate pair of episodes, you know, pair of chapters.
Yeah. It probably helps that we did these two episodes almost back-to-back, so it feels like we jumped very quickly, but...
Like, four chapters, bing, 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 bing. Like, yeah. We're there.
I mean, six chapters within the last week, really, so...
True. Yeah. All right. So, yes, we are going to start with chapter 17, entitled The Lost God Speaks. They ran, and they ran, and they ran. Rachel kept them out of traps, but otherwise, they were just fleeing Kronos and his horde of monsters. Rachel finally reaches her limit, she's mortal, and they stop to rest for a second. Rachel catches her breath, Annabeth is sobbing with her head between her knees, and Percy and Nico have a quick chat. Nico definitely outed himself to Kronos back there with the wall of obsidian, and Percy wanted to thank him for saving them. Annabeth is definitely grieving Luke and not wanting to believe he's entirely gone. Percy believes no part of Luke is running the show anymore. He may be in there, but he doesn't have any power. The moment with the hairbrush is discussed and retired. We kind of discussed it last time, so you guys will get that. Nico stops the fight and reminds them they really must keep going. Just before they are ready to leave, Percy sees Grover's red Rasta cap. They follow the cave path ahead and find Tyson clutching Grover's limp body, but their favorite satyr is still alive, just again overwhelmed with the very nearby power of Pan. They take a brief detour to actually find Pan, who is grateful that Grover found him so that he can finally take his rest and pass on. Grover begs him to stay longer and to, you know, to remain in the world, but Pan insists that the wilds he used to have dominion over barely exist anymore. It is now them, those of nature and those of human origin, that need to keep the patches of the wild that are still alive thriving for many years to come. Then it was time for our quartet, I guess it's a quintet now, to get back to finding Camp Half-Blood, so they head back into the labyrinth on their way.
I'm going to say right here, at the top of both, you know, of this entire section, I cried my way through both of these chapters, like, intensely, had very much trouble keeping it together.
I might have been too tired to cry.
Really?
When I read it, but I do, like, it does feel like a gut punch after gut punch in this little section.
These are two very heavy chapters.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Okay, so I think one of the more interesting bits of this chapter for me is, like, Percy and Annabeth's take on what's happened to Luke.
Yeah.
Because Percy was there, saw it happen, saw the gold take over his eyes, and saw this guy who has been, you know, both a friend and foe in the time Percy's known him, and he watched it all happen. So I can understand why Percy is like, he's not there, Annabeth. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't see it. But Annabeth wanting to cling to, you know, her friend being able to come out of this and still be her friend, knowing how much good Luke was capable of in his life, is like, no, 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 at the end, you saw it, you know, Kronos didn't have power in that stunned moment, so Luke is still there. And there really isn't a right answer, it's just,
yeah,
they both have their ideas, and it kind of puts them at odds for a bit.
Yeah, this was kind of an intense chapter, and I completely understand why Annabeth doesn't want to believe what she saw, and I think with her crying and everything, she's coping with reality, she's going through the stages of grief, and she definitely doesn't want to accept what she saw. And I think not only is she holding on to hope now that Luke is still in there because of what they saw when Rachel hit Kronos in the head with her hairbrush, I think that Annabeth has been holding on to hope this entire time that she could get to Luke, that she could bring him back to their side. And in this moment, seeing him in that way, I think she kind of knows that's no longer an option.
The whole quest, she's been holding back things and keeping secrets, and she's been a little overwhelmed with learning that she has less control over the labyrinth and that all of her knowledge isn't going to save them and they need a mortal to lead them through. I do think that it's all been a lot for Annabeth. Mm-hmm. And in this moment, seeing the person that used to be her confidant, her best friend, the guy who helped keep her alive, seeing him, like, completely different and seeing Kronos take him over, like, it's got to be way more than any 13-year-old, 14-year-old
yeah,
at this 14, point,
I think, yeah.
would ever be able to handle. Like, it's, I can see why in this moment she's holding on to whatever she can, but is just, like, breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's been through a lot.
Yeah, and I really don't want to take sides here because I think both Percy and Annabeth have a reason, have very good reasons to feel the way that they do. I will say that I was, like, slightly annoyed with Percy because he's mad at her. But again, I still understand, like, where he's coming from. I think part of it is jealousy, which yeah.
I get it. It's been a through line the whole
book,
so you can't ignore it.
I get it because he clearly has feelings for Annabeth, and he thinks that Annabeth still has feelings for Luke. And that doesn't cause logical thoughts. It's not like, oh, Luke was Annabeth's brother, basically, like, her older brother. He kept her alive, like you said. They've been through so much. There's so much history there between them. Of course she's going to feel this way. Those feelings don't go away overnight. And she's still coping with the fact that he's on Cronus' side, let alone that he might possibly be dead now.
Yeah.
And I get the jealousy, but I feel like Percy is also angry for another reason that I couldn't, like, quite put my finger on.
Well, yes, I do. The jealousy definitely factors in.
Yeah.
And they're young, so, yeah, you do get jealous quickly over crushes and things like that. It happens. It's just part of growing up. But I also think that there might be a factor of, like, she has been jealous of him and Rachel this whole time. And now that Luke is, like, gone, and Percy feels like he doesn't have... And, you know, like, I think in Percy's mind, he's thinking, okay, if Luke's gone, then there's nothing to be jealous about. Like, I don't need to, you know, I don't necessarily think he's consciously thinking this, but just playing in his head is, like, if Luke is actually out of the picture entirely, then there's nothing threatening about that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that might kind of be playing into this, too, is that Percy is taking Luke out of the picture, and Annabeth is just kind of like, you know, how dare you? Like, he was important to me, not necessarily as a love interest, but, like, just as a human being in my world, he played a major part for a long time, and you're dismissing his entire being because now Cronus has taken over his body. So, like, I can see, like, there's another level on which they're fighting that isn't necessarily definable, but, like, there's some extra irritation going on.
Yeah, I definitely think you have to factor in the fact that Percy feels betrayed by Luke's decisions and can't understand. Like, he's angry because of that. And then he sees Annabeth being sympathetic toward Luke still. That's like a betrayal on top of betrayal. And I don't blame him for being angry like that. And I will say, like, they do kind of fairly quickly come to terms with, like, okay, we have to keep moving. You know, I'm sorry, like... they don't really talk about it, but they get back on the same page a little bit, and I appreciated seeing that.
And this doesn't compare at all, but Percy did kind of, he looked up to Luke, like, he was excited to have a friend and kind of a mentor a little older than him that could teach him the ways and all of that, and he lost that really quickly, so he didn't have time to really cling to it, but Percy lost something here too, and it's all very complicated and difficult, so basically there's just a lot to kind of mourn. And while Percy doesn't necessarily have a strong grief, Annabeth's is literally overwhelming and just pouring out of her.
I really appreciated seeing, because most of the time she is a little bit more stoic, I think. And, like, she's cried before in the past, but it's definitely not her go-to emotion. And the fact that she is completely overcome with this goes to show just how much it's actually affecting her.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so yes, they decide then, I mean, Nico's kind of like, hey guys, I know this is important, the stuff you're talking about, but we gotta move, because monsters are definitely on their way. And before they can take more than, like, 5 steps down their path, Percy shines his flashlight and sees Grover's red Rasta cap.
Yeah.
And it's got muddy footprints all over it, and it doesn't look good, but they decide to follow the cave anyway, and I love that Annabeth here does kind of join Percy's side, like, his side, but, like, they, you know, she immediately is like, we have to go, he's our friend, like, we have to go. So despite Nico and Rachel Elizabeth Dare kind of being like, guys, I'm not sure, we do kind of step off to that, and away they go. And we find out very quickly that both Grover and Tyson are alive.
Yes.
And that they survived whatever onslaught Kronos threw at them.
Yeah.
Which was all kinds of things. Tyson lists them all and is like, it was this, and then it was this guy, and then it was this thing, and but we made it.
Yeah.
So they fought together and survived, which is really sweet. But yeah, so we find them, and they're basically in a cave. There's a stream, like, next to them, and Tyson's just holding Grover, and it looks bad. But as soon as they get up there, Annabeth recognizes this is just what he looked like when he was overwhelmed by the presence of Pan. And she quickly says, like, we just need to wake him up. Like, he'll wake up. We just need to wake him up. So then they find Pan.
They find Pan. This was a really intense scene for me for a lot of different reasons. They stumble upon one of the last little pockets of the wild, and it's full of extinct animals. And I really loved the visualization of, like, the dodo and the woolly mammoth and all of those kind of things. And then you have Pan himself, who is old, who is fading. He's kind of sometimes fading into mist, and sometimes he's kind of solid. And it's essentially because everything he stood for is gone. And the only reason why he lingers is because the satyrs wouldn't give up hope on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he essentially tells Grover that they've drawn out his painful passing by not letting him go.
Yeah.
Which, on one hand, I think is like a very good lesson of like moving on with your grief and letting things go and, you know, putting things in the past. And on the other hand, it's like, wow, Pan.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
That was like a little mean.
Right? Like, dude,
I'm suffering because of you.
They didn't
thinks.
Know you were dying. They
yeah.
thought you were lost. So it's, you know, they weren't purposely extending your pain and torment. Yeah, it was accidental pain and torment. Oops. So yeah, they spend some time with Pan, and quickly he just asks to be released, and Grover's like, I can't do it. And then he does. And
yeah.
Pan dies. My biggest thing here was, couldn't Pan have, you know, gifted Grover something that he could take to the Council of Elders?
I kept thinking that, too.
And just some sort of proof that he met Pan, that Pan requested to be let go, and that Pan is no longer, and now it is their job to take over. Like, just something to give him a leg up with them. Because, obviously, coming back with nothing and no proof, they're going to not believe him. They're going to say that, you know, he doesn't get to move forward as a searcher, even though there's nothing to search for anymore.
Right.
Like, they're going to strip him of all the things he loves and wants. Like, just give him something.
Yeah. I think that was a lesson in faith a little bit, you know, to carry on the story and not need the proof to kind of do that. And luckily for Grover, at least, he has witnesses that can back up his story.
True.
And corroborate.
And
like,
quite
everything.
A few of them between
yeah.
Nico and Rachel and Tyson. I mean, Rachel probably won't make it to the Council of Cloven Elders.
Right.
But, you know, like, he does have quite a few eyes on to explain exactly what they all saw. So
yeah.
That's true.
I really loved Pan's final lesson, which was that he wants everyone to take up his spirit. It's the only way to rebuild his lost kingdom. And of course, this is all about preserving the environment and making it so that not one person is responsible for it, but everybody is responsible for their little corner of the earth. And I've always loved stories like this. One of my favorite book series of all time, probably my second favorite behind Percy Jackson, is T.A. Barron's The Lost Years of Merlin. And a lot of what Merlin is about and the kind of sister series Avalon is about is taking care of the environment. And there's a lot of really lovely lessons in those books. And it's very much like, if you enjoyed this thing with Pan, if you like Grover's storyline, please go check out those books. They're a bit older, but they're so good. I love them so much.
I was going to say, and if you want a real life example, I spent most of yesterday, and I will probably spend most of today, watching shark content on Disney Plus. They're all like 44-minute documentaries. Like, it's a whole bunch of different ones, whatever. One of them was about looking at coral reefs that are pristine and have not been touched by man, and looking at how they are healthy and how a healthy ecosystem looks, because like, we know of, like, the Great Barrier Reef or some of the reefs near Florida or the Caribbean, and none of them anymore are healthy. Some of them are still alive and trying to flourish, but, like, none of them are actually healthy anymore because of the proximity of man to them. So they went to these four islands that are off the Caribbean, but, like, they're far enough off that they are have not been visited by man in centuries. Mm-hmm. Like, they may have been stopped at by explorers who planted things like coconut trees that did wreak some havoc, but for the most part have been mostly untouched. And, like, the ecosystems you're looking at and, like, just, like, kind of understanding that man is on this earth and we are natural, but some of the things that we do now are so unnatural that it does have an effect on things that we don't see. Like, and looking at these ecosystems that are completely untouched and how magical they are and all the things, and they learned all kinds of things from that. I forget exactly which special it was because I watched a whole bunch of them, but I want to say it's something like the Lost Wilds or something like that. It was really, really good, and a lot of the stuff on Disney, like, they're all National Geographic specials.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. We're a big fan of, like, animal documentaries and documentaries in general, but Disney has some really, really wonderful ones, and they, of course, have National Geographic stuff on Disney Plus. And I just reviewed one of their newest documentaries, which was called America the Beautiful, narrated by Michael B. Jordan. And the last episode in that series is all about conservation and what people are doing to save the ocean and to save the Great Plains in America and, like, certain wildlife species and stuff, like the Florida panther, which is very rare. And I think that was my favorite episode in the series because it's just really nice to see people working so hard to fix the mistakes that humans as a general group have made and to try to, you know, save these animals and bring them back to life and even the ecosystem itself to rebuild that. So there's a lot of things to.
So if you're looking at Pan and you're like, I like this message, there's so much that you can kind of, like,
exactly
see and, you know, watch and experience through these documentaries and then, you know, maybe find a way to help because there's all kinds of
help. Yeah.
This has been your PSA.
Right, exactly. My last point about this section is kind of twofold. One, I felt so bad for Grover. I was so, so sad because of what he was going through. But I liked the faith that Pan put in Grover to be able to convey this message. And Pan gave each of them very specific hope.
Which I also loved that it wasn't just Grover, like, his message is for everyone.
Yeah, he kind of talked to each person and said, things will work out fine, just stay the course. And he did that before he finally passed, and I was like,
like, even Rachel Elizabeth Dare got a message from him, like, you know, especially, apparently things are tense with her father, and he kind of just gives her hope that it's going to find a way to be okay. It, you know, just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, no, gotta love Pan. We should probably wrap this up, do quotes and moments. So I'll go first, I guess. Mine was a cute little moment between Pan and Dee Dee the Dodo. Pan says, Dee Dee, what are you doing? And he goes, are you singing Kumbaya again? And I just quite enjoyed that Dee Dee just breaks into Kumbaya every time Pan talks about moving on. It's like, what are you doing? Are you
such doing? A sassy little dodo.
Right? I love it. What was yours?
Mine was the lesson that Pan kind of gives them. And he says, you must tell each one you meet. If you would find Pan, take up Pan's spirit. Remake the wild a little at a time, each in your own corner of the world. You cannot wait for anyone else, even a god, to do that for you. And especially that last line is just so powerful. And I think people should consider it. Like, yes, have whatever faith you want or believe that there's a higher power who is driving your life forward. But at the same time, like, make sure you're taking individual action. Make sure you're taking care of your own space and your own people. And I think that you can live a really wonderful life that way.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful little message in a middle grade book.
Right, exactly.
Rick just knocking our socks off right and left.
Yeah.
I also wanted to throw a little bonus moment / quote in here. Dee Dee the Dodo sings It's a Small World. And I'm like, What an interesting Disney reference I know. That was, Rick.
I was thinking that too, from The Lion King, right?
It's also from the Small World ride.
Oh.
The Small World song started with the ride, and then they did a little throw-in in Lion King.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There's verses, and it's long, and It sticks in your head, and it's a whole thing. But I just thought it was really funny that the reference was made, and I'm like, this is another one of those little things that they can totally throw into the show,
it would
be fun. So, yeah. Okay, and then now we'll move on to favorite moments. Mine was Annabeth not trying to control her emotions and just letting her grief kind of take her over and get it out and cry. As much as, like, I just love the idea that Annabeth isn't hiding from anyone or anything in this moment, but also that, like, she just has to give in and let it run its course. She knows that holding it in is not going to help, and she's got a lot to worry about and think about, and she knows they still have to save Camp Half-Blood. So, I think just letting herself have this moment where Rachel needs to take a break anyway and just let as much out as she can it's so smart, and she's amazing, and I love her. Okay, what was yours?
When they meet Pan, pretty much that whole section. Yeah. I just loved it.
I mean, it makes sense. Okay, so now we are up to chapter 18, entitled Grover Causes a Stampede. Rachel successfully guides them back to New York City, and that is where they must leave her behind. She can't come to camp, of course. She and Percy say goodbye, keeping the door open for them to reconnect and maybe hang out sometime. They all climb onto the Pegasi, after the Pegasi complained about both Nico and Tyson, and make the flight back to camp. They meet Chiron and Salinas in the cabin area, by the way. Just an aside. I was like, who's Salinas? And it took me a minute to realize he was one of the satyrs on the council. So in case anyone here is like, wait, what? I haven't read it yet. Okay. Chiron hears Percy out and isn't mad. Salinas doesn't believe Grover or the others and insists Pan is alive, but they have to abandon the discussion due to Luke's army making their way closer and closer. Each house has a job that utilizes their strength. Whether it's on the front lines or as an archer in the background, everyone is valuable. Cronus's army finally attacks, first with the Lystragonians, then the Impusai, and eventually Camp, too, of course. Percy helps Grover and Juniper by dousing a fire near her tree with as much water as he could summon. Annabeth, Percy, and the other campers do away with the giants and the Impusai, but Camp is another story. Just when Percy and Annabeth think all is lost, Daedalus, Briares, and Mrs. O'Leary come bounding out of the labyrinth, slaying as they go. Yes, the hundred-handed one returns. Then Grover unleashes a mournful call, one of grief and fear, and all the monsters flee back into the labyrinth. Daedalus decides it's time for him to die and take the labyrinth along with him, hopefully crushing the monsters still fleeing inside. He gifts Annabeth a laptop full of notes and plans. Nico releases Daedalus from his life, and then he fades away.
Again, super intense, cried a lot.
These fighting chapters, man, they have, like, there's not a lot to actually describe about the fight. You hit some of the high notes, but, like, there's not a lot. But, man, like, they just, they pack a punch.
Yeah, they really do.
Especially as you're, like, worried about people and characters dying, or possible dying, and you freak out a little bit. Okay, so, yes, we are saying goodbye to Rachel Elizabeth Dare. For now, we all know she'll be back. But yes, for now we have to say goodbye. And I just can't help but, like, wonder, like, will they hang out? Like, I want them to hang out in the off season, like when Percy's not at camp, if there is a time for off seasons. But it made me just think about their friendship.
Yeah, I was curious if, like, there is something more, because Percy kind of says, like, his feelings the last couple of days have been very confused between Calypso and Annabeth and Rachel, it seems like, too. And, you know, obviously, I am very much a Percy and Annabeth person, but I love Rachel as a character. And I just, it's like, it's kind of messy without being, like, overly done. Like, it's not overt. And I appreciated that, at least.
Well, part of me can see the appeal to Percy of being with someone like Rachel. Like, I don't necessarily think he has, like, strong feelings for her. I think he's just excited to have a friend that he's more connected to, because Annabeth has strong connections with everyone he knows now.
Yeah.
And Rachel and him kind of have a thing, and so I think he likes that. But I can see the appeal of maybe being with a mortal that can see through the mist. Like, he doesn't have to explain himself or anything around him, but at the same time, she's not in his world and involved in all of the mm-hmm. complicated craziness going on. So, like, being with her could be both an escape and also, like, the best of both worlds.
Right. And with Percy not really knowing exactly how Annabeth still feels about Luke and maybe not knowing how she feels about him, having Rachel there that they clearly, you know, have some sort of connection, I can understand him being like, okay, which way do I go?
Right. Yeah. It's all very understandable. We'll just put it that way. Okay. So the Pegasi, as they show up, are quite whiny. Tyson's too heavy, and Nico smells too much like death, and I just kind of laughed.
Yeah, I love them when they show up.
They're such a wonderful tension killer. Like, we've had so much craziness going on with Kronos, and the last chapter was really heavy. To kind of have a moment with them where they're, like, freaking out about how Nico smells is quite lovely. But yes, so the Pegasi pick them up and take them to camp, and they land in, like, the cabin area, and immediately are, you know, Chiron and Salinas are both there. And, yeah, so, like, they get there, they have a little breakdown of, you know, what happened, and Grover delivers the news to Salinas, who doesn't believe him, and all of that. But one of the things that happens kind of in this discussion is Annabeth tells Nico to do something, and he listens. Immediately after, Nico has not listened to Percy at all. And I don't remember ever, like, paying attention to this. And I was like, did I miss something? Is there a reason that Nico is, like, apt to listen to Annabeth in this moment? Like, I understand maybe why he wouldn't listen to Percy, but it doesn't necessarily explain why Annabeth can tell him, go do this, and he's, like, gone. Like, I'll just do it.
I think it's kind of because it's not Percy telling him, but also because Annabeth probably approaches him in a different way than Percy does. So I can see her, like, she is kind of, not that Nico would necessarily know, but she is a kind of a big deal at camp. Like, she is one of the leaders. She's a powerful warrior. She kind of knows how everything works. And I feel like Nico, I could just understand why he would look up to her a little bit. So
it was just an interesting moment. And Percy even asks about it. Like, why is he listening to her? Like, what the heck? So I just thought it was, you know, worth noting. And I'm curious if maybe this comes up again. Like, maybe Nico explains why listening to Annabeth is, it works for him.
I'm pretty sure that this comes up again in a different way later on, if I'm remembering something correctly. Mm. But I don't know if it's, like, obviously connected to this. But this reminds me of something that's discussed later on.
Very vague. I like it.
Yeah.
we'll get there eventually. Okay, so Chiron is not at all surprised when Percy tells him that Quintus was actually Daedalus. Wait, come on, Chiron, stop keeping secrets. Like, if you knew, or if you had an inkling, that would have been very useful to tell them earlier. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, it's one of those things where mentors keep secrets that they don't need to keep. It's not okay. I feel like Silenus's reaction was pretty predictable.
Yeah, I was annoyed, but I was expecting to be annoyed.
Right, and so now I'm curious what Grover is going to get from the entire council. Like, will they all react like Silenus, or is there a chance that some of them will believe him and that there's a possibility of them, you know, working to actually do what Pan instructed and, like, kind of separate and go to the ends of the earth and help it and take some, you know, take care of little patches of the wild that they can. So it'll be interesting. We'll find out. I loved that during the battle, and, like, before the battle, every house has a job. Like, even Aphrodite is, like, going around and checking armor and, like, making sure that everybody's, like, together. And that it's just, Aphrodite would be the one, I think, that people would be like, well, they don't really have much to do at battle. Like, but even they are finding ways to stay busy and to help and to keep things together.
So. Yeah, this was one of my favorite parts because he was specific to mention Aphrodite doing that and, like, combing the horsehair and making sure there were no tangles, which you would think is not that big of a deal, but I just like that they were, like, taking care of people.
Yeah.
And also Dionysus's kids were making sure everybody was hydrated, which, again, is, like, relevant and important, even if it's not, like, the Ares cabin literally getting ready to go into battle.
Right.
It's still an important, like, link in that armor that if it wasn't there, something could go wrong. So, right. Yeah, I really liked that he highlighted all of these.
I thought so, too. It's just an extra little thing that, like, you would assume that people in Aphrodite or other assorted, you know, related cabins wouldn't have much to do. So instead of hiding, or something like that, they're out helping as much as they possibly can. And I just really like that, too. Kyren and Percy have a little discussion of Luke, but it's they don't really, like, get to the heart of the matter, either. Like, it...
There's no answers, because essentially they talk about how it's possible that Luke and Kronos fused, that it shouldn't be possible, that Kyren's never heard of this before. And I found this particularly fascinating, because that is the very concept that the Kane Chronicles is built on, is that they are able to take in the spirits of the Egyptian gods, and that's sort of how the Kanes, you know, have their extra special powers and that sort of thing. So, and we know obviously that the Kane Chronicles and Percy Jackson exist in the same universe. They're a different pantheon of gods, so I understand why there could be different rules for each of them.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious if this is kind of later on, like if they find an answer to this, or if it's just like, hey, Kyren didn't know the answer, but it doesn't mean that it's impossible. Obviously, it's not impossible because Kronos did it, but
right, yeah.
If they ever actually discuss that the Egyptian gods have this ability and maybe the Greek gods don't, or something like that.
Yeah. As someone who has not read the Kane Chronicles, I am very interested to kind of see how the different rules for different belief systems change how they relate to the gods and how humans do and all of that. So I'm definitely intrigued. And we'll get to that later again. Again, we'll just push it all off. It'll be fine. Okay, so next up is the big battle. Like, For big battles, this was kind of huge. I mean,
this was a big one.
Not quite as big as some of the ones we'll see very soon, but I would say it definitely qualifies as the biggest in the books so far. You've got all these different monsters streaming out of the labyrinth, and it's just one thing after another. It's a hellhound, it's the Impusai, it's the Laestrygonians, it's, you know, it's just bad thing after bad thing, and they're doing their best to keep up, and they do pretty well.
And, you know, just, again, a reminder, 14 years old, this is a full-on battle. It would have been bad enough if it was, like, other people with swords and stuff, because you could still die that way, but these are, like, monsters. These are mythological beings with powers and scary teeth and talons, and it's just terrifying, the fact that all these kids are like, we don't have any other choice. You know, it's just, I try to really keep in mind, like, how big and heavy all of this is.
Well, and mixed in with those monsters are some of their friends that have defected to the other side and are also coming through with these. Like, that, again, it's another huge thing. Like, it would be one thing if they were two human forces, but to have monsters along with people you once called friends, it's all very heavy, that's for sure. I was super excited to see Briarez, because last we saw him, he was like running off to hide and go die and, you know, whatever, and Daedalus finds him along the way and brings him, and it makes Tyson's day, you can tell.
Yeah, there are several, because like you said, in terms of the actual battle, there's really no point talking about, you know, they clash swords with this person or whatever, like, but there are some very human, like, emotional moments throughout the battle. My big one was every time Nico uses his powers, I get chills because he is so powerful for such a little kid. His sword can absorb monster souls, which, like, hey, that's cool and useful. And he can command the dead to serve him. And that was just like, I literally got full body chills when I read that scene.
Yeah.
I knew and remembered that I loved Nico, but reading back and analyzing things a lot more closely and discussing it, I'm just like, wow, this character is really amazing on so many different fronts.
And he does so much with his power and is able to do great things. And then at the end, you're can't help but be a little worried because he's all like worn out, and they like run to him and bring him nectar and have him, like, you know, start to feel better. But like, he went to an extreme to really help here and do as much as he possibly could. And it just shows that Nico, as much as he was questioning going back to camp at all, like, he does really care about it.
Yeah,
like,
and he's a good ally to have, and I hope that the other campers see that and appreciate that. Yeah, I just kept crying throughout this whole scene, too, because everything was so intense. Tyson telling everyone to stand and fight, like, when he kind of talks like a little kid sometimes, when he... gets that like leader quality in him, I'm just like, whoa, who are you? You know, like that was really cool for me. Mrs. O'Leary and Daedalus coming back, like, oh, that, especially Mrs. O'Leary, because you know I have a soft spot for her, but that was just such an epic scene when like all looks lost and then they come back and they don't quite turn the tide, but they help a little bit.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. But yeah, the whole battle is pretty intense, and I also loved the moment with Percy saving Juniper's tree.
Yeah.
It was just a very sweet little thing, because, you know, Grover's doing his best to use his reed pipes to bring as much water as he can, and Percy's like, the stream is too far away, but he's able to kind of summon that strength that he's used in this book a couple of times now and brings enough water to save her tree, and that made me happy. Okay, so in the end, after all the fighting and all of that, Grover lets out this weird, fearful wail that sends all the monsters running back into the labyrinth, and all Chiron says is, we need to talk about that.
Yeah. And then you don't get answers. Right? And, like, I don't even think Grover really knows what happened.
No, I don't think so either. Yeah. And it's just very surprising, but you're like, thank God. Like,
yeah.
You know, at least there's that. At least they found a way to get out of this battle without losing too many people. And, yeah. So that was all very surprising and crazy. And we also get at the very end of this chapter, Daedalus makes a pretty big decision. And to have Pan make this almost the same request that Daedalus makes here, it's so weird.
Yeah.
Like, we had Pan who was being clinged to and needed Grover to, like, let him go. And here, Daedalus is kind of saying goodbye and, you know, basically saying, I'm done and I'm going to die. And Percy's thinking, like, you can't kill yourself. That's not cool. And then Nico, like, almost does the same thing Grover does and just lets him be at peace.
Right, yeah. It's a very heavy scene, and I think that I think this was the right choice for Daedalus because he shouldn't still be alive. It kind of was going against the natural order of things, and he didn't want to live in hiding anymore, and he wanted to take responsibility for his previous actions with Icarus and Perdix. And so choosing to die and shutting down the labyrinth in order to help them, because that way the Titan army would be trapped down there, that, you know, Cronus and his army wouldn't be able to use the labyrinth to travel anymore. They really needed that because it was obviously very dangerous that they had access to that.
Yeah.
But he also gives Annabeth his computer full of some of his work, and again, crying, just so many tears, because I knew how much that meant to Annabeth. It wasn't everything that he ever had, but the fact that he gave it to her because he felt like she was the right person to carry on his legacy, kind of huge, again, for a 14-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you have Nico finally admitting that Bianca has to stay where she is.
Again, heavy chapter.
Yeah, yeah. And just being like, I'm not going to trade Daedalus' soul for Bianca. I know that she died doing what she wanted to do. I know that she had to stay there. Nico's kind of learned his lesson through Daedalus that you can't go against the natural order of things. Again, huge for a child to come to terms to. And then, on top of that, Percy gets Mrs. O'Leary, and when Daedalus dies, she howls in despair. And I was just sobbing at this point.
like, what more can you do?
Yeah, it was so sad. But I do love that Percy was gifted Mrs. O'Leary.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. I do love their connection.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but just a lot of heavy thing after heavy thing, and thinking about Annabeth and all the things that she can do with Daedalus's head start, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know she's excited, but also, like, terrified and grieving because Daedalus is her hero, and you know, it's it's a very heavy end.
Annabeth's also gone through a lot between Luke and Daedalus, especially. Yeah. Like, dang,
this has been a big book for her, just all kinds of stuff. Okay, so that wraps up that we have reached the end of this chapter, and we have two left, and then this book will be done, so that's crazy,
man.
Okay, so favorite quotes, I'm gonna let Karen go first.
Okay, so this one. I think this also made me cry. I'm just an emotional person, you guys. I'm sorry. But this was after Percy saved Juniper's tree. And he says, Juniper held a stick like an old-fashioned whipping switch. She looked really angry, like she was going to tan somebody's backside. And I love that Juniper isn't necessarily known for her fighting, but right. like she was pissed that she almost died and that her tree was almost murdered. And she was like, yep, somebody's going to pay for this. And she just, you know, went into battle.
She'd be small but mighty.
Yes, exactly.
yeah, no, I love Juniper. So that I did love all of that bit with her and Grover for sure. Mine was between Annabeth and Percy. It was a little exchange, as I'm, you know, always fond of. And Annabeth says, this might be it. And Percy says, could be. And she says, nice fighting with you, seaweed brain. And he goes, ditto. I was like, Percy, that's the best you can do for the last thing you could possibly be saying to Annabeth. You're going to say ditto? I'm so mad at him.
It reminds me of Ghost every time somebody says ditto, because she says, I love you. And he always says ditto back to her.
Like
the movie Ghost with Patrick Swayze. So long really? Since I saw Patrick it. Swayze and what's her face?
Demi Moore,
yeah. And she would say, I love you, and he would say ditto instead of saying I love you back. And then to prove that it was him after he was a ghost speaking through Whoopi Goldberg, he was like, tell her I love her. And Demi Moore was like, that's not him. He never told me he loved me. And so he was like, tell her I say ditto, ditto. And then that like was the whole thing. So every time anybody says ditto, that's what I think of.
Meanwhile, all I can think of is the Pokemon.
Yeah, that's another ditto, close second.
Ditto. Yeah, no.
I was really hoping you would take this line, though, because the whole, like, you know, nice fighting with you, seaweed brain, like,
yeah,
I really loved
it's
that.
It's pretty big. It's pretty iconic, I must say. Yeah. Like, it's just, this could be it, and this is what they say.
Yeah.
Percy. Okay, and what was your favorite moment?
When Daedalus and Mrs. O'Leary came back to help.
I mean, you can't
beat it.
You really can't.
Triumphant.
Mine was Percy and Annabeth. It kind of goes with my favorite quote. It's them putting their differences aside and getting the job done. Like, they've just gone through all of this stuff and they just fought in the labyrinth, like, you know, maybe an hour before. And they're able to just kind of set it all aside and be allies on the battlefield. And, you know, they just shove it aside. It's like, it's not necessary. We don't need to deal with it. We need to survive. Here we go. And they're fighting side by side. And it just, it's a lovely little thing. I love it. Okay. That wraps up these chapters. Make sure to read the final two chapters in Battle of the Labyrinth. And then we will get to move into the last Olympian
text. Yeah.
Coming up.
We're closing in.
Yeah. It's wow. Getting real. Okay. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning in to Rewatchable, which has covered series like Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, and Angel, and many more. Most recently, we've also discussed all four Matrix movies. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that features our biggest hypes and gripes in fandom and life, and we even post interviews with our favorite creators. Lastly, we have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has previously discussed every episode of the show, conducted many interviews with the cast and crew, and will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. Please find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms, and consider leaving us a review or rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and we appreciate your help with that. You can leave us questions and comments in any of these places, plus ideas for content you might want to see or episodes you want to hear, so please reach out. We do have an email this week from our friend Henry. I will send this over to Karen and let her take it.
Thanks. Henry's been catching up on some of our episodes, so he wrote in a couple of times, and I kind of compiled a few of the things that I wanted to talk about really quick here. He starts off by saying, so I heard you guys talking about the one dream that Percy had about Daedalus, which was a flashback of the scene where he kills his nephew Perdix and is then cursed by Athena. You guys discussed a bit of whether or not Daedalus's motives for this were driven by his anger and bitterness of losing Icarus and being in the labyrinth. If I'm not mistaken, I think the scene that Percy saw took place way before Daedalus' run-in with Minos and the labyrinth, according to the original mythology. I remember reading in Percy Jackson and the Greek Heroes that the incident with Perdix, although a little different from Percy's dream, took place at the beginning of Daedalus' story and is what got him banished from Athens, where he was eventually forced to seek asylum with King Minos, and that's eventually how the labyrinth got built and all of that. So the answer might be that Daedalus' motives for killing his nephew were purely jealousy-driven. And I went back and also just looked this up to confirm, and Henry's absolutely right. So he killed Perdix first because he was jealous, and it was a little more active in the original mythology than how Percy saw it. But pretty much everything else was the same. So he did this because he was jealous and then was driven from Athens, and then Icarus and that whole story. So that was kind of Daedalus's beginning, was this incident with Perdix. So
no, I appreciate you writing in about this, because honestly, it wouldn't have occurred to me that we were watching it out of its context. Like, it didn't occur to me that this could have come before Icarus. So that does kind of inform the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So that's, thanks for letting us know.
Absolutely. He also says, so to start off with episode 39, I love the reviews for the Battle of the Labyrinth. I always think very fondly on the chapter taking place in Ogygia with Calypso. Despite that entire experience taking only one chapter, it's so complex and developing. I think an entire episode of the TV show should be used to adapt the course of Percy and Calypso's story, a very pivotal point in the franchise for sure. Aside from that, I think it's also worthy of highlighting that this book is quite literally the only book in the series where Percy returns to Camp Half-Blood mid-quest. There were just a lot of groundbreaking moments in this book. I'm constantly torn between whether The Last Olympian or The Battle of the Labyrinth is my favorite PJO book. And that's really interesting on all fronts. I also kind of think Calypso's Island should be, like, maybe not like a whole episode start to finish, but like a good chunk of an episode, because there's just a lot to like explore there, and it takes place over several, well, 2 weeks, I think, right? So it kind of would make sense that we would stay with Percy a lot on Calypso's Island.
I'm gonna be the voice of opposition, because I hate it when shows do that.
Really?
It's one of my pet peeves.
Like you don't like bottle episodes?
Not if they completely remove a character from the show's setting. One of my least favorite episodes of Stranger Things is the one where Eleven goes to that random group of kids and does all that stuff. And we don't see anyone from our group or the actual plot line for an entire episode. Yeah. It feels like such, like, I understand it's necessary for Eleven's development, but, like, it feels so foreign to the rest of the show. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind a bottle episode every now and then, but I think you could do a good chunk of Calypso and the story while still connecting to all the things that are going on in this book. Like, there's just, in the previous book, you've got Clarice running around and doing all this stuff in the background, and there's so much going on in Battle of the Labyrinth while Percy's not there. I think intercutting with Annabeth grieving because she thinks he's gone, and, like, I think that could be really powerful. Not necessarily spending a lot of time with Annabeth and Camp Half-Blood, but I think by that point in the series, we will have spent so much time with Annabeth and with Chiron and all of them that completely abandoning them all to do a bottle episode would feel really foreign. And
I think that's fair. Yeah. I think that cutting to Camp Half-Blood, especially seeing Annabeth with Hephaestus and, you know, all of that, would be very interesting. I love bottle episodes, and although I didn't particularly like the Stranger Things one, I just think that's...
It was just the only example that
you no, I don't think that's a very good episode in general, but... like Mythic Quest did a couple of episodes that were bottle episodes and they didn't even have the characters from the show in them. They were completely, or like one of them was a flashback episode for one character, and another one was basically the origin of the building where they have their company set, and it's with characters that are not in the show ever again, and it's one of my favorite episodes of the show. Like, I know some people don't like it for that exact reason, is because it doesn't actually move the plot forward, but I like it in terms of like expanding the universe, and also I think there are very interesting parameters that you have to stay within when you do bottle episodes or like bottle books, you know, where things take place in one setting and you never move from that. So Teen Wolf has some really good bottle episodes.
I was gonna say, they can be well done. I know West Wing has one at the beginning of the third season, because 9/11 had just happened in the real world, and they took an entire episode, took it out of the context of what was going on in the show, and basically did an episode explaining to people, like, basically illustrating that, like, the people that did this to us are not the norm in, like, the Muslim religion. Right. Like, these are not devout Muslims that should be followed. Like, it basically all of that. Like, looking at the whole situation within this character's perspective. And I think it was really valuable. So, yeah, I think bottle episodes are touch and go with me. Sometimes they can be really good, and sometimes they drive me absolutely insane.
Yeah.
So, I do understand the appeal of it, but I just think there's so much going on that you could tie it back really easily without leaving the importance of Percy and Calypso, but maybe, I don't know, maybe getting across the length of time they've spent there too would be helpful.
And this would be a really interesting way to expand the TV show in a way that the book wasn't expanded. You know, to go back to camp, to see what the other people are doing, to get into Annabeth's head a little bit more, to get into Chiron's head, you know, figuring out what's going on. I think that would be really cool.
Yeah.
The last thing Henry says was, one more thing, the name of the third doppelganger you guys were trying to remember, played by Nina Dobrev, is Amara, the lover of Silas. However, you also forgot that Nina played the fourth doppelganger, Tatia, in a season 2 episode of The Originals.
I always forget about Tatia.
Wow.
It's not because she's not important, but I always forget she's a doppelganger.
Yeah.
Because she is the one that bound the original curse, like, to make them vampires.
Gotcha, gotcha.
Her blood is what they drank that day. And it's very important to the story mythology of the whole world, but I always forget that she's actually a doppelganger.
Man, so yes, four doppelgangers. Yeah.
She played four different versions with her body, with her face.
That's interesting.
Yeah, four different characters. So crazy. Okay, so next week we are hopefully going to be looking into the Industrial Light and Magic visual effects documentary. We just think, while it doesn't have a ton to do with Percy, knowing as much as we can about ILM and their history and everything that's built them into the powerhouse that they are now and what they is coming forward with all that technology is really going to be interesting, seeing how that can help and how it relates to the Percy show. So
yeah,
we're gonna watch it, take a look at what it means and what it could mean for Percy. We probably won't see any footage in the documentary. Becky made sure to clear that up. We wanted to just make sure you guys knew. We're not expecting footage or any mention of Percy really at all, but just kind of looking at how important they are to the
I'm more interested in the history and how this technology came about, because that's one thing that we didn't really talk about when we talked about this previously. And also if they mention future technology and how it's currently developing. If there's enough information there, we're definitely going to do this episode. If there's not, if this is like a repeat or if nothing's really relevant enough to what we think Percy Jackson, you know, could be the show, then we'll find something else to talk about. But
We're excited, and we think this is going to be a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
So we'll see how it goes, but cross your fingers. Okay, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.